Good morning. It's a real pleasure for us to have among our program of seminars of this year, Hanf Iskarsson, or something like that.
Closer, very close.
Very close?
Yes.
Okay. Who will talk about puzzle about bigness, now ability and judicial discretion. The topic of bigness is not new for Hanf. Is in fact the main topic of his PhD dissertation, who made with André Marmor some years ago, and now is PhD researcher. No, sorry. Postdoc researcher in the University of Iceland, and today here in Girona with us for our pleasure.
Thanks. I was going to say the pleasure is all mine, but hopefully that's not going to be entirely true. I'm very happy to be in Girona. I've been wanting to visit for quite a while, and I think. It's interesting to present the kind of work that I do, which is often at the intersection of philosophy of law, meta-ethics, and philosophy of language. It's interesting to present it wherever, and sometimes it's quite interesting just because you have to present it in a way that's, corresponds nicely to the audience. But so it's rare, I think, that you are able to sort of present the paper as balanced as it tries to be. Sometimes I have to sort of try to sway the balance in favor of if it's mainly meta-ethicists or if mainly philosophers of language or mainly philosophers of law. So both in Barcelona and here, I think it's a kind of environment where I feel comfortable just presenting the paper without any sort of tweaks to make the philosophy of language stuff interesting to people who maybe don't care so much about language. I mean, not for themselves, at least. But that is really, in particular, I mean, I work on those sorts of issues a lot. And vagueness, of course, is maybe one of the most prominent ones. But this paper in particular is a puzzle that arises because of sort of mainstream commitments in each of these fields. So that's why this is sort of squarely at the intersection of these fields. And the reason a puzzle is generated is because people, in particular in legal theory, in particular Joseph Raz, but a lot of people, other legal positivists, accept certain views about judicial discretion, certain theses, and certain theses about language, namely vagueness, sort of very standard account of vagueness. And then they accept certain constraints on what it is to be a reason. And this all seems very consistent until you really spend, unless there's a crazy person who wants to spend many months trying to figure out whether there's a tension or not, and then he's very happy when he thinks he's found attention because, you know, fruit of the labor. But the devil really is in the detail. And I know Diego told me some of you have read the paper, others probably not. So I'll try to tread middle ground. I'll try to keep it reasonably short, and then detail would hopefully arise in the discussion. The master aim of the paper is quite modest. I mean, it's not a modest paper, I think, in content. It's quite dense because I wanted to cover a lot of ground. But the aim is quite modest. It's just to say, look, if you accept Joseph Raz is a target. He's not necessarily a target. Anyone who holds these three theses is the target. And that legal positivists, most prominently, but it might cut across a range of views. But basically, The idea is to say, look, I can understand why you would hold these three theses, but really they don't fit, they don't align, and so whichever way you go, you have to make some revisions either to your views in legal theory, or to your views in metaethics, or to your views in philosophy of language. And because all of these, the thesis that they are attracted to, which I'll explain in a minute, because they are sort of mainstream views, standard views, we could call them in some sense, all of them, rejecting any of them would require sort of, or it gives you very deep commitments in these fields. And so basically, the aim of the paper is to recognize that there is a misalignment, that the misalignment requires revision in some of these fields, and that there's a big commitment. And basically, especially legal positivists need to say much more about the way in which the enactment of vague legal provisions gives subjects reasons for action. So if you have the handout, and if you've read the paper, there are fewer theses on the handout than there are in the paper. And I'm suppressing some of them just for the sake of brevity. But basically, the first 8 pages or so in the paper, I sort of try to detail all the theses that are responsible for generating the puzzle, the inconsistency, just because I want to map out as much as possible. Map out as much as possible all the possible points of pressure. Then, depending on where you, I think your overall commitment in philosophy of language, metaethics, philosophy of law, you will want to push different things. But it's good to have a map to see exactly where you want to push. It's inconvenient maybe if I go over there.
No.
Okay. So basically the basis of the puzzle is rather, rather simple. It's lots of theses. These are the main theses. So it starts with vague language that, let's just use an example to make it a little bit more concrete. So let's say that there is a regulation, council tax on dwellings. Council tax on dwellings. This is a board example from Rouse, I think. Council tax on dwellings, and because dwelling is a vague term, this is, I'm sort of giving the usual legal positivist story for how we get from vague language to judicial discretion, namely the thesis that in case it's indeterminate whether the legal provision applies to the case in question, at least legally speaking, the court has discretion to decide either way on basis on extra legal considerations, if you want to call it that. So the usual story, just says that if it's borderline whether and a predicate applies to an object, then it's indeterminate whether it applies to that object. And this applies to language generally and also to legal provisions. So that's one assumption, that there's no, this is one move, one step. I think most, all of the steps are supposed to be supremely palatable to the legal positivist, at least. And this is all good, like, in the paper, the pages in RAS who point to where he just explicitly says this, so that it's not something I'm reading into RAS, or the legal positivist thinking. And from legal provisions to legal content, where we take legal content to be the set of legal reasons provided by the enactment of the norm, we need a bridging principle, and the bridging principle is that the one I use in the paper is that the legal reasons that the the enactment of a vague norm, or any norm, including vague norms, gives rise to, the legal reasons directly correspond to the language used in the enactment. A lot of people will want to resist that right at the outset. This is what's come to known as the communication theory or community content theory of law, which has met a bit of resistance in the past 5 years or so, from Mark Greenberg, Larry Solow, Dale Smith. But in order to generate the puzzle, we only need a subset. Like, for a reasonably robust set of norms, this is going to be the case, that the norm directly corresponds to the language used in the enactment. And I think, at least for the positivist, any positivist would have to say, well, at least in some possible legal system, there will be a set of that kind. So I think it's, even if you want to resist the universal claim, it's hard to get around the puzzle at all. I don't see a way to get around the puzzle if we just contract it to a robust set of cases. Anyway, then we're down to the reason. So in borderline cases, so say it's so the law, in case your property is a dwelling, the law, that's a reason for you to pay council tax, if we stick to the concrete example. In case your property is borderline dwelling, just because of the features it has, it's indeterminate then that you have a reason, or whether you have a reason to pay council tax. And if you decide not to pay, and your case goes to court, then the judges have discretion to go either way because of that fact. Why? Because if it's indeterminate that you had a legal reason to pay council tax, it's indeterminate whether you ignored a legal reason to pay tax, in virtue of which it's indeterminate whether you you violated the norm that would otherwise, it's indeterminate whether you violate the relevant norm that determines the legal reasons that you have to pay council tax. And on the basis of it being indeterminate whether you violated the norm, discretion is produced. That's sort of, so discretion is a function of the legal, the normative structure facing the subject with respect to the relevant action. So this is the usual story. And it's fine. And it's a story that I want to keep. So I'm most invested in this story. And I want everything to align with that kind of thinking. I mean, in the paper, I tried to be a bit non-committal. So if it just turns out that it's an impossible story, and it really does get into trouble by the other theses, then maybe we do need to revise the usual story. I want to resist that, but at least in the paper, I want to be open to all possible points of pressure. So I always want that. I say that, as I stress that, because a lot of times people think that I am arguing for something like a conceptually necessary rule of lenity, so that I'll come back to that later. Which I'm not. This is the prong that I want, and I think once we add the other theses, that's when we get the misalignment. So they are my preferred targets. What are these? Well, they are what I call ignorance of language, and then I'll add knowability later. So ignorance of language is not really an independent thesis. It's a further thesis of, it follows from standard theories of the nature of vagueness, linguistic theories. So everyone working for the past decades on linguistic vagueness have said, either they've said it follows from my account that if P is a borderline proposition, such as this is a dwelling, or if you name your house something, Ella is a dwelling,
Such propositions are not knowable. It's impossible to come to know borderline propositions. And that's sort of a central feature of theories of vagueness, either because it's taken to follow from the way they analyze cases of vagueness. So some analyze it in terms of absence of matter or fact. So there's no fact of the matter whether my property is dwelling. If there's no fact of the matter, it's impossible to know that it is a dwelling. So another thing that it's epistemicist, that it's rooted in and other features more having to do, so there's a fact of the matter whether my property is a dwelling, but it's impossible for us ever to come to know it for conceptual reasons having to do with conditions of knowledge. What matters is not the individual accounts, but just that everyone is committed to this. And if it's not a feature of the review by entailment, like Stephen Schiffer, he just says, well, it's just obvious. It's the platitude that which ought to accept. It's just stares in the face. So ignorance of language either is produced by standard theories of vague language, or it's independently motivated just as a platitude. Ignorance of language is just that for any borderline proposition, like John is tall, if he's borderline tall, it's impossible to know. With the dwelling case, so if my property, it's impossible for me to know that my property is dwelling, then it's impossible for me to know that the legal provision applies to it. And if it's impossible for me to know that the legal provision applies to it, it's impossible for me to know that my property as a dwelling is a reason for me to pay capital tax. This has been parallel reasoning so far. This is where the parallel ends. That it is impossible for me to know that my property as a dwelling is a reason. Is a reason for me to. So there's just a very subtle distinction here between. So the problem is not that it's impossible for me to know that it is a reason, but just that it's impossible for me to know that I have this reason because it is indeterminate. It's not that there is a reason and that produces. There is a determinate reason there, and then it's impossible for me to know it. It's that it's impossible for me to know at all this proposition. It's a subtle distinction, but it matters a bit, just the way we present the issue. So far it's a good parallel reasoning. Then we add knowability. So knowability is a condition proposed by Joseph Raz on what it is, a general condition proposed by Joseph Raz on what it is to count as a reason. It's an existence condition on what it is to be a reason. So there are different things that he says in actually this book right here, From Normativity to Responsibility. But one of it is, if P is a reason for you to phi, then P is knowable for you, to you. And knowability here is just that something like, at least in his terms, if you weren't to put in your best effort, then you would come to know that P. That's knowability on his terms. You might expand that, and for the purpose of the paper, you can expand it to, you can have a very weak constraint. You can say, well, it only has to be knowable by anyone with normal human epistemic capacities. So it doesn't really matter whether the epistemic constraint is weak or strong, as long as there is an epistemic constraint, the puzzle is generated. Because the impossibility of knowledge in case of borderline cases is very, very weak. So the problem is that if it's indeterminate, if P is indeterminate, that my property's dwelling is unknowable. If that's indeterminate, then it's unknowable that it is a dwelling. But if it's unknowable that it is a dwelling, then by knowability, it's determinately the case that it is not a reason for me to pay council tax. So ignorance of legal reasons and knowability actually produce a conflict with vague legal reasons, which say it's indeterminate that you have a it's indeterminate that your property's dwelling is a reason for you to pay council tax. Knowability eliminates, so it takes the indeterminacy and makes it via the impossibility of knowledge into determinate non-reasonhood. It's an ugly phrase, but it gets to the point. So these are inconsistent. I mean, the whole set of theses, of course, is inconsistent, but I single these out as the problematic ones. So knowability gets everything into misalignment. And further, if we keep the assumptions constant, then if it's determinate that my property is dwelling, it's not a legal reason for me to fire, then if I don't pay council tax, I have not ignored, there isn't any legal reason provided by the council tax norm that I'm ignoring. And if that's not the case, I determinedly have not violated council tax regulation, and if discretion depends on whether or not I have violated the relevant norm, then there is no discretion and I should be found in favor of, which produces a conflict with discretion. So this is the root, really, but then it further... So these are in conflict because of knowability, but further, because this is supposed to produce discretion, then there's a further conflict further down the road. So this is the puzzle. This is the overlooked story. This is the usual story. And so the question is, what should we do? And what revision should we make? And I mean, one point of the paper is just to show that any move we make, there are huge commitments. In particular, if we want to keep this constant, if we want the usual legal positivist story about judicial discretion, then we need to revise either ignorance of language, we have to give up the thesis that it's borderline propositions are unknowable. This is a huge commitment because it's either taken to follow from any standard theory of vagueness, or it's taken as a platitude, so major revision, or we have to revise knowability. So say something about the epistemic constraint on what it takes to be a reason for action, and that takes a lot of work in metaethics. Now, people might care more about metaethics, care more about philosophy of language, or they might just care about legal theory and say, well, these other disciplines will sort themselves out, and they'll take care of it. Once they figure out, they'll see that this story doesn't need to be changed. But that's sort of that's a little bit of a self-centered way of thinking about the entire issue. And one of the reasons I'm interested in the intersection of these fields is that it takes a lot of work sometimes to keep your views that have commitments, because this view has commitments in philosophy of language, it has commitments in theory of reasons. But once we trace them properly, we sometimes run into trouble, significant trouble, and this is one of those times, if I'm correct, of course. So I identify a few, so on page 2 of the handout, I identify a few ways, possible ways out. Some of them I say I don't think they work, others I say I think these are the most interesting or most promising ways to go. But really, I'm a little less committed than that. I just really want to know where we should go. If I'm wrong in recommending one, I'm perfectly happy to switch to it. I'm just very interested in knowing whether we should be paying attention to metaethics to philosophy of language, or to legal theory, or to both? Like which parts are the most movable of all the many theses that the paper contains? Only some of which, of course, are up here. So just to go through some of them quickly to get to the ones that I spend most time on. So a lot of so one of the reasons why the paper is intended to be an invitation to legal positivists, including myself, to say much more about the way in which enactments of legal provisions give subjects legal reasons for action. I forgot how I started the sentence. That's pretty good going. Right, no, I remember now. Thank God. This is on? Okay. So basically, there hasn't been done much work on exactly how we should talk about these things. I mean, the way Rast talks about borderline cases, I mean, there's lots of work been done on vagueness and the law. I mean, more than you'd think. Maybe not as much as on the theory of nature law and legal interpretation, of course, but enough at least so that there's plenty work to be studied. But there's no consensus on, there's been no debate about how we should characterize normatively practical scenarios in which your available courses of action maybe depend on P, and P is indeterminate. It's all just about assumptions. So in the usual story, Raz mostly assumes a way of talking, and there's no dialogue about how to really characterize the scenarios. So this is the usual way, but another way people informally talk about case of vagueness is where the law gives you no reason either way. So it just both Andre, Gideon, Yafi, and other people sort of wondered whether maybe if we think about it differently and say cases of vagueness, borderline case is a case in which it fails to give you reason either way. That's maybe how we should characterize it. And if that's how you should characterize it, then the fact that this produces nullability produces the absence of a reason, absence of a positive reason to fight, absence of a reason to pay council tax, for example, then that's not doesn't produce an inconsistency. We just have to also remember that we don't have a reason. So we don't have a. There's a failure to provide a reason to pay council tax, and also a failure of the reason not to. So failure to provide reason either way, the suggestion was, maybe at least is an acceptable possibility to explore. And this is one of the most puzzling. I keep coming back to this option, just because it's far from settled that this is not a possible analysis of these kinds of scenarios in general. I don't like it, but that's more of a gut feeling. I'm still exploring just if it might work. And then this is less of a problem. Maybe the puzzle can be regenerated, but that's a further issue. But my main point of resistance, that's not just based on intuition about how we should think of these scenarios, is that with certain reservations, I mean, you might be able to make some. I'm not saying there aren't responses to this, but I think what this distinction or this suggested analysis it doesn't make a distinction between cases of vagueness, proper borderline cases, and then other cases about which the law is truly silent. So there are lots of endless things that the law fails to give me reason either way to do.
It doesn't give me a reason to go to the gym. It doesn't give me a reason not to go to the gym. It doesn't give me a reason to eat well. It doesn't give me a reason not to eat well. So once, if judicial discretion is a function of the normative situation of the subject, and this is the correct analysis, the no reason either way, of the practical of the normative scenario, that just means the structure of the reason involved in the scenario, then that would predict judicial discretion in all cases about which the law is truly silent, which seems to be obviously false. So it's sort of, unless there is lots of further tweaks to this suggestion, which I haven't been able to identify, this seems to be the wrong kind of analysis. And in addition to that, I'll keep my intuition that it seems correct to say that the normative failure in those kinds of cases is not as stark. It's not such that there's no that there's a failure of a reason, positive reason, and a failure of a negative reason, but that it's incorrect to say that there is a reason. That's not quite a failure. So it's closer to having normative bite than the failure to provide a reason either way. It seems to be I don't know if this is a clear point, but it's the wrong kind of normative oomph that it predicts. It is more of a normative pull in, I think, my analysis, that it's indeterminate that there is a reason, rather than a failure to reason, failure to provide a reason either way. So maybe we can come back to that later, but it's also been proposed that retroactivity might take care of the issue. So if this is true, then they didn't violate, so there isn't a reason. In case I don't pay council tax, there isn't a reason that I ignore, if this is correct. So you might think there's no discretion I should be found in favor of, but in the U.S. and the U.K. elsewhere, retroactive law is not unheard of. So retroactive tax law, maybe in the States, common law discretion in the U.K. There seem to be exceptions to the thesis that in all cases in which you have determinedly not violated a norm, a legal norm, you ought to be decided in favor of. There are exceptions. It's not a universal norm, or universally true statement. So maybe what's going on is just retroactive lawmaking, and that a lot of people think about judicial decisions in borderline cases as retroactivity. It's some kind of lawmaking. And lawmaking that affects previous actions, or the legal status of previous actions. Okay. There are a number of things to say about this. One is just that it obliterates the distinction between weak and strong discretion. So intuitively, there's something worse about making actions that were determinedly, say that in the court, this is a weird example. I apologize to the lawyers who know that law could never work this way. But let's say that a case comes before the court, and there was no council tax regulation. It was just that the system decided, look, let's go pick up some people that have properties that count as dwellings. We'll put them before the court, and the court's going to say, I know that there was no rule yesterday requiring council tax of dwellings, but now there is, and we are fining you for not having paid. Because yesterday you didn't pay, but you owned a dwelling. That seems worse. So blatantly retroactive, maybe it's a bad example, but you can make a better example. Blatantly retroactive law seems intuitively, very intuitively worse than what's going on in cases of when borderline cases are adjudicated. Maybe it's retroactivity in the sense that it sort of cuts off some doubt, or it settles the matter, fills a gap. But it seems to be a weaker form. Why weaker? Because it's not as bad. Well, the weakness and the evaluation, I submit, are explained by the difference in the normative scenario involved, which means that the suggestion was there is, bite the bullet, there is no distinction between blatant retroactivity and adjudication of borderline cases. That just seems very hard to keep. And on top of that, it doesn't take care of the inconsistencies. It just says we should focus on this and try to bite the bullet, but that doesn't take care of the inconsistencies. Other suggestions have been to say, look, how am I doing on time, by the way?
Oops, I don't know what time is it. 50 minutes.
50 minutes? Good. This sort of moves by analogy. So sometimes we, at least if certain philosophical theories are correct, we have partial credences towards certain propositions. So you might have a degree of confidence in a proposition P. And it's easy enough to convert these into probability judgments. I think that there's a 20% probability of rain. Whereas before, where it reflects a 20% credence in that it will rain. So you can convert these into sort of the probabilistic, or the credences into probabilistic judgments. So whereas 20% towards the proposition that it will rain, but I have 100% towards the proposition that I think there is 20% chance that it will rain. So maybe we can expand, in the case of vagueness, the domain of legal reasons. Maybe I have been too conservative, and it's not just P that matters. It's not just that it is a dwelling that matters for adjudication in the matters of council tax and non-payment, but actually that it is indeterminate. So it's like a meta proposition. It's a determinate meta proposition about the indeterminate proposition. Maybe that's something that you ignore if you don't pay, and which is the basis of discretion when it goes to court. And we can, it's not just an abstract idea. A lot of people have, Waldron, Scott Soames, have put, and Timothy Endicott, anyone thinking about vagueness thinks sometimes about vagueness as giving notice-based reasons. So you're, with respect to the borderline cases, you're put on notice that you might, there's a chance you might be prosecuted and might have been, get a fine or imprisoned or whatever. And so maybe ignoring that reason is tantamount to it being indeterminate that you violate the norm. So if you violate, if you ignore that it is indeterminate, that P, maybe once you ignore that reason, that's equivalent to you having it being indeterminate that you violate the norm. Even if that it is P is not a reason for you to do as directed. And this is, there's definitely something there. I mean, in all of these suggestions, there is something there. That's why they're in the paper. But I want to resist calling this legal reasons in particular. I mean, there are two issues. One is that it takes the function of discretion, or it makes the discretion be a function of the wrong kinds of reasons, I think. I mean, the force of the suggestion is to say, no, you're wrong. But two issues. So let's take a comparative example. Let's say that I promise Diego that I will pay him $10 if the next person that walks in the door is bald. Then the next person that walks in the door is borderline bald.
And the question is whether I have a premise-based reason to pay Diego $10. So you might say, to when we're talking about so this suggestion, you might say, well, let's say I have reasonable expectation that Diego is more violent than he looks to be. Sorry about the example, but it's in the paper. So I have this reasonable expectation that if I don't pay him, I will be beat up. Not right now, but no, afterwards, maybe during lunch or something. So I have a reason to pay him in those kinds of cases. But I'd be very resistant to calling it a promise-based reason. You can have all sorts of reasons downstream for having made a promise, but only some of them are probably characterized as promise-based reasons. And two further things. If we're biting the bullet, then you'd have to say, I determinedly did not break my promise to Diego. Because of no ability. I determinedly did not break a promise to you. But it's still correct to say that I had a promise-based reason to pay in the proper sense. And if Jordi is, if we argue and we go to Jordi and we ask him to be the arbitrator and say, please, you decide. And I say to him, look, no ability. Look, I read this book by Joseph Ross. It's a great book, and it shows that I did not break my promise. Determinedly, I did not break my promise to Diego. And he says to me, yes, but because of this external reason, I will still hold that you ought to pay. It was incorrect for you to withhold payment to Diego. Even though you determinedly did not break a promise. And that seems very counterintuitive. There might be some tweaks. Maybe it's unfair that it's a sort of a threat of violence, whereas you might say, what about reasonable external considerations, etc. But that doesn't seem... So there seems to be a difference, at least in the claim that I make, whether I'm able, even if it's legitimate expectations on behalf of Diego, maybe, whether I'm able to say, but it was a borderline case. Like, why are you going his way rather than mine? Or I'm able to say, look, I determinedly did not break the promise. That's got to count much more. And so it doesn't seem like, if we don't tackle this, I don't think it's a good scenario. And once we tackle this, there's no need for this elaborate comparison with expanding the domain of legal reasons, etc. I'm going to jump over whose reasons. It's just a suggestion for saying, look, forget about the subjects. Let's just focus on the reasons that the officials have. And I think that's a very radical idea because it requires making discretion sort of a direct function of just the facts of whether the predicate applies, not a function of the reasons that the norm gives the subjects. And that's this sort of radical revision of how we think about the legal normative structure of the law. And in particular, I think it's... I mean, some legal positivists might be happy to, but I think it would require a sort of a very radical rejection of the law as a normative system. I mean, maybe some positivist a la Kelsen, where you think just norms are just directed to... it gives reason to officials, but nobody else. That would be the equivalent, I think. But that seems to me a pretty radical move to get around this problem. But does the argument equivocate? This is sort of this is a very interesting suggestion. So you might say, well, nobility interacts with the ignorance. Nobility interacts basically with this claim. So the nobility in the case, so in order for us to be able to draw the conclusion, the unknowability has to be of the same kind. It can't be different or else the argument equivocates and it doesn't go through. So maybe vagueness-based ignorance is different
from ordinary factual, and maybe nobility only applies to factual. I don't think, I mean, it would require a distinction, a sort of analytical distinction between the two types of ignorance, and I don't think that's a very easy way to go. Even if the sources are different, the matter of fact seems to be the same, you don't know that P, or it's impossible for you to know that P, even though the grounds are different. So it's very difficult to make this distinction, I think, in a good way, and you certainly can't have vagueness-related ignorance entail sort of a more general category of ignorance, because then you can just, by the entailment, you can regenerate the puzzle. But what the suggestion does, it makes us pay attention to whether nobility maybe if we restrict nobility just to determinate cases. So maybe the nobility constraint doesn't come out of the blue. It comes from the fact that it's knowledge or a possibility of knowledge is required in order for you to be able to rationally respond to the relevant fact that counts in favor of some action. And that makes sense if we're talking about determinate facts. But if we are, maybe what's the rational response in case of vagueness is something different. Maybe it's a different cognitive state. And there's very recently work has been starting to be done on this issue. What sort of attitude should we take? Or try to take, or what are the limits of the attitudes we can take towards borderline propositions. So maybe there are different cognitive constraints in indeterminate cases, and if that's correct, and nobility only applies to determinate cases, we don't get the problem. So this is something that's a lot of work needs to be done to make this palatable, but it's sort of a nice way to go. So the two that I think are most promising, and we'll conclude with that, is this ignorance of language, that it's impossible to know borderline propositions. This is a central claim in all standard work for the past decades. But there are dissenters here and there. Mostly there are just two of them, which is not a huge ratio, but you might say, well, there are two ways to make this, to change this into borderline cases or borderline knowable, which keeps the alignment. So you might say, what if as a conceptual matter, there are never clear borderline cases? So the whole puzzle and most of the literature on vagueness and philosophy of language, philosophy of law, has assumed the existence of clear borderline cases. But if there aren't any clear borderline cases, and there are people who hold this, Delia Garafala, a host of other people, Kit Fine, even in his seminal paper, one of the main papers on theories of vagueness, suggests that it's very, very difficult to find clear cases. And one explanation might be there aren't any. So that might motivate us to think, well, borderline cases are borderline knowable, something like that. Or you might have other grounds and just say, well, it's just a fact about knowledge and borderline cases that If you're a perfectly situated cognizer and you know all the facts relevant to P's truth value, then there's no matter of fact whether you are in a state of knowledge or a state of non-knowledge. It's borderline. So it's a non-standard revision of this main thesis, but it gets everything into alignment. So it's an easy way, but it has a lot of commitments in philosophy of language. Another way that I think is a little bit more interesting, at least for legal theoretic purposes, is to say, well, you've been talking about reasons an awful lot without really going much into what it is to be a reason. And so Scott Shapiro, following Ras, following Kelsen, reminded us that maybe we can distinguish between, well, at least two senses of legal reason. You might think, well, in one sense, legal reasons are just real reasons, like ordinary reasons. Facts that count in favor of certain courses of action. And a subset of these are legal reasons,
reasons that are there in virtue in the right way of the actions, etc., the existence of legal institutions and legal authoritative action in the right way. And then we might say, well, also we might have pure legal reasons, which are, one way to explain that might be, those are real reasons, but from the perspective of the law. So according to the law, or from the perspective of the law, A has a legal reason to phi. That's a pure legal reason for A to phi. It's not a real reason, but it's from the perspective of the law, it's a real reason. And that's makes sense if we accept the claim that the law purports or in a robust way aims to give legal reasons for action. That's sort of the idea behind that. And then you might say, well, for the first notion, the knowability constraint that the fact has to be knowable to be a reason applies straightforwardly. But if we're talking about pure legal reasons, then it's not an existence condition, but at least it might be a standard of evaluation. So you might have borderline legal reasons despite knowability, but knowability directs us to evaluate that as a complete guidance failure. So it doesn't change the legal story, the story here about judicial discretion, as long as you think of judicial discretion as being a function of pure legal reasons. Knowability is just an external evaluative criteria for saying, look, when the law does this, it's really a total failure from perspective of action guidance. And that matches well with the no reason either way view, sort of, which is a bit problematic. So that's one way to go. And then it doesn't affect discretion, but knowability is an external evaluative dimension that reflects on discretion. The problem is it reflects completely negatively on it. Some people are happy with that. And they would say, yes, and that is why you ought always, or there's always a huge reason in favor of deciding in favor of the defendant, say, in these kinds of cases, because the law totally failed to give guidance. I think that's not quite true. It's problematic. I mean, I don't see it as total failure to guide action. It's indeterminate. Or it's at least it's a milder form of failure than complete failure when you're faced with a borderline case. Like, you have some guidance. Seems to be the right way to think about it. And if that's the right way to think about it, it also means that you should have a more, you shouldn't have a totally negative view towards judicial discretion. And it seems like there isn't such a completely negative view. Like, discretion is viewed as, I mean, there's something to be said in holding in favor of defendant in these kinds of cases. But I think that doesn't hold universally, as this predicts. There are this variation in whether discretion is appropriate or not. And this variation is explained in part because I think the guidance, the action guiding failure isn't total, which makes me think that maybe even though revising ignorance of language, just focusing on philosophy of language, just focusing on meta-ethics and distinguishing between two types of legal reasons, I think maybe the best solution to the puzzle, at least so far that I've been able to gather, might be to have an over-determined solution, to revise our standard theories of language such that borderline proposition or borderline knowable, and distinguish between the two levels such that knowability applies as an external evaluative dimension, not as an existence condition. And that aligns, I think, especially for the positivist, especially for the rational positivist, it aligns the facts of the matter, the facts of judicial discretion, how, what it is and how it is a function of the structure of reasons facing the subject, and our evaluation of the action guiding failure. And I think with that, we should turn to Q&A.
Okay, thanks.